Okay, now good morning, everybody. This is BIO 241, and it is still January sometime, January 30th. All right, so today I'm going to pass around a sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, because that is your receipt that you're in class. And sooner or later, I'm going to start looking at everybody's attendance, and if you're not attending class, then I have to drop you. It's especially true for online and hybrid classes. So make sure you sign this right now. So if you come to me later this afternoon in lab or tomorrow and say, oh, I forgot to sign in, can I sign in now? Guess what? I don't know if you were in class or not, right? So this is when you're in class, so be sure to sign this. And if I forget to pass it around, please remind me earlier in the lecture rather than later. Okay. Okay, so some people have ordered textbooks, but they haven't come into the bookstore yet. And so I want to show you a little bit on how to, I don't have a student account opened up right here, but I can show you how to get free access to your textbook for, I think, 21 days. All right, and if you bought a new textbook, you do have an access code, and you'll have access to the e-textbook the whole semester and whatever else is in that McGraw-Hill site. So if you don't have a hard copy of your textbook, but you want to start reading and preparing, go into Blackboard. And of course, everybody knows how to get into Blackboard now, right? Is there anybody that's having trouble getting into Blackboard? Nobody. Fantastic. Okay. So go into Blackboard. Of course, you're dumped into the announcements page right away. Then just go down to Tools. And in Tools, of course, you're going to go there to look at your grades, right? So you can click on My Grades and just keep track of all your grades. But this is McGraw-Hill. This is who publishes our textbook. And if you click on that, I've paired each of the sections up with the textbook. You click on that, and since I'm already enrolled in McGraw-Hill, since that's good, just say go to my Connect section. And since I'm already registered, it's going to bring me right into the textbook, right? So I can click on that. Since you haven't registered yet, it's just going to ask you for your email address, your registration code, and then you're going to have access to this thing right here. If you, I wouldn't purchase it if you're going to get a new textbook because it's included in the new textbook. But if your new textbook hasn't arrived, when you click on register, it will give you an option for a 21-day free trial. So just sign up for that, and when your textbook comes in, then you just pop your access code in there, and your trial period won't disappear after 21 days. Okay, so you'll be able to do that. So what was it? Blackboard, Tools, McGraw-Hill. Okay, you'll get the feel for that pretty quickly, I'm sure. Okay, and then once you're in this McGraw-Hill area, it's just a different learning environment paired up with Blackboard. To get back to Blackboard, this is a good icon to click on. You probably could go back arrow, back arrow, back arrow, but I'm not sure that works best in all cases. All right, so just hit back arrow. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about Blackboard. Anybody got a question about Blackboard so far? Ooh, today's Thursday. Ah, online assignments. When are online assignments due? Thursday at 11 p.m. Ah, except you get a little breathing room this first week, right? So it's not due until next Thursday, but there are 2 weeks due next Thursday, week number one and week number two. So get started on it. Don't push that off to the very last minute because for sure, I will not reactivate an online quiz, past the deadline. So make sure you know that you can take a quiz an unlimited number of times before the deadline, but how many times after the deadline? Zero times. Yeah. Okay, so that's just some good time management skills. And you have that weekly study planner, right, to work on your time management skills. Okay, no questions on Blackboard. All right, let's go back to what we were talking about in chapter one. Chapter one, right here, let me make sure I get my arrows right. And I want to do something with the monitors. Let me see what I want to do. Do I want to do that? No. I want to do this. Okay. All right, so sorry, one of the one side of the projection system, even up here, is stretched way out, and you can't see it. So this is the only projector that's really working properly, and I don't know how to rescale that one that's going off the page right there. All right, but so I'm going to turn some of these lights down. So we're going to be working just with this monitor over here, just on the right-hand side. Okay. All right, so let's see. Where the heck were we? Went through all these things. Oh, we learned a bunch about homeostasis and just how to tell if a system is in homeostasis by looking at its profile. And you can see if that parameter always goes back toward the set point, then that's negative feedback that's being employed and the system is in homeostasis. So it's really easy to tell. This is probably one of the most important concept maps in the book. So you really just got to memorize this. And it kind of just builds on what you learned in anatomy already, which is a reflex. But this incorporates a little bit of feedback, which you didn't see in your anatomy textbook. Okay, some definitions. Extrinsic regulation is regulation that takes place in an organ of your body, but that organ is being controlled by things on the outside, maybe an autonomic nervous system. Intrinsic regulation, remember, is when an organ has the ability to adjust itself. It doesn't need a nervous system or an endocrine system or anything like that. Okay, and I think this is where we left off last time. Some examples of positive feedback, which normally produce a disease state, because it drives the system which way? Down to the set point or up to the set point? Or how will positive feedback affect the system with regard to set point? It keeps going away, right? Keeps going away from set point. And if it's an elevation, if it's above the set point, it will keep going above. If it's below, it's going to keep going below. Okay. It will just never be taken back to the set point. Some of these normal processes right here, that positive feedback is stopped, and negative feedback is resumed, the organism goes back into homeostasis. How is a positive feedback, a normal positive feedback mechanism like these four right here, how are they stopped so that a person goes back into homeostasis? What has to happen? Something drastic, right? Like parturition, for instance. There's ovulation then. That's something drastic, and then that stops the LH surge, for instance. Okay, because the positive feedback mechanism cannot go on forever. All right, so on this slide right here, somebody actually asked something. I use this as an example. Okay, why things are not constant inside your body. So if you're lying down, you have really nice blood pressure. Let's just say it's 120 over 80. You'll find out why. There's two numbers involved with that. But as soon as you stand up, your blood pressure is going to fall. And it might fall down, it might decrease so much that you lose consciousness. So that's a dangerous situation, right? You don't want any syncope. So the stimulus then is going to be a decrease in blood pressure. Oh, and what does the response loop always start with? A stimulus. So here we're going to begin a response loop. And it's a decrease in blood pressure because this person went from a lying down position to standing up. And you might get a little bit dizzy, but there are receptors in the arch of the aorta, in the carotid sinus as well, that can measure blood pressure, right? So that's the second part of a response loop. You have to have a receptor or a sensor, and then the sensor sends information to the integration center. How does it get into the integration center? Afferent pathway, sensory pathway. Right, so information goes into the central nervous system, the vasomotor center, cardioregulatory center, and the medulla, and it compares this low number to the set point and realizes your blood pressure is decreasing. And it makes a decision right away before you pass out. Right, so then it sends the decision out via the efferent neurons to the heart and to a couple other places as well. Your lab notes have a little bit better description. But one place it goes is to the heart. All right, so what do you think the effect on the heart is going to be? If your blood pressure is decreasing, is the decision from the cardioregulatory center to slow the heart down and make the contraction weaker? No, it would be the opposite. It would increase the rate and force of contraction to raise the blood pressure back up. Right, so heart rate increases. And this effector then is going to produce what does an effector always produce? A response. Yeah, so response loop always starts with a stimulus, ends in a response. And furthermore, you could understand what kind of feedback is operating by looking at the stimulus and response. If they subtract from each other, that's what we call negative feedback. If they add to each other, that's positive feedback. Okay. All right, so that person's blood pressure then goes back to normal and they do not pass out. All right, so that's something that happens in a very short period of time. And I want to tell you the name of that mechanism. I want to tell you that a number of times through the whole semester. It's not on this slide right here. I don't think you talk about it or the book talks about it in the first chapter, but it's really important to know. So this is short-term regulation in blood pressure, right? As soon as you stand up and you start to pass out, this mechanism can prevent you from fainting. This is what's called the baroreceptor reflex, and that you have in your notes in lab. Barrel, a barometer, is something that can measure pressure. Atmospheric pressure if you're a weatherman, blood pressure if you're in somebody's carotid sinus or aortic arch. So baroreceptor reflex is the most important reflex for maintaining blood pressure in the short term, rapidly. Okay, not day to day, not week to week, month to month. That's a different mechanism. Okay, and this is illustrative of the two control systems that you have in your body. One operates very quickly. One operates a little slowly, actually very slowly. But if it operates quickly, the duration of action is short. If it takes a long time to work, then the duration of action is long. That's why there's two of them. So this one right here is activated, has an effect very quickly, but the duration is for a short period of time. This is due to the nervous system. Nervous system responds very rapidly, sends signals rapidly over our body. The mechanism that can regulate something in the long term, like from week to week, month to month, usually involves the endocrine system. So endocrine system and nervous system are involved with controlling or maintaining homeostasis, but in a little bit different way. One is fast, the other is slow. All right, so you've probably heard of a condition called diabetes mellitus. And what can you tell me about diabetes mellitus? What's a physiologic parameter that we should be considering? Blood sugar, that's right. And blood sugar, just like blood pressure, temperature, and many other things, should be maintained within a range to support life. And that range should vary right around the set point. Okay, shouldn't go too high, shouldn't go too low. All right, so let's take a look at what regulates blood glucose, because it's an important energy molecule. There are these little organelles called mitochondria that need glucose to make ATP, and ATP is that energy molecule inside of our cells that can maintain all of those processes that require energy. So we have two states when we think of blood glucose. We have a state, here somebody is eating, we don't want to call that the eating state, we want to call this the fed state, F-E-D, fed state, right? And then over here, somebody is not eating, and we can call that the fasted state. So this slide isn't too bad, it's got the fasted right. So you got fed or fasting, these are pretty much the two situations. So the fed state is one, right after breakfast, right after lunch, right after dinner, lasts for a little period of time, maybe 2-3 hours, something like that. The fasting state is after that period of time, after about 3 hours, your food is all digested and you're no longer absorbing nutrients from your digestive tract. Like first thing in the morning when you wake up, are you in a fasted state or fed state? You're in a fasted state, right? Because there's no longer any nutrients in your gastrointestinal tract. All right, so we're going to look at these two conditions. Well, let's just say you're in a fed state and you're eating regular food, and of course regular food has all kinds of glucose in it, and you absorb that glucose. Glucose is a nice simple sugar, can be used to make ATP. So when you're in a fed state, glucose enters the blood from your digestive tract, and there's plenty of glucose in your digestive tract. And it goes into the circulatory system, goes everywhere in your body, including the pancreas. And the pancreas has a receptor for glucose. So it knows what blood glucose concentration is. And that's where the integration center is. If blood glucose is rising or is too high, its decision is to secrete insulin. Right? So insulin is secreted in the normal individual when their blood glucose is increasing. And what insulin is, I think I mentioned this last time, is a passport. It allows glucose to enter cells, to leave the blood and enter cells. All right? And as glucose enters cells, then of course the blood concentration decreases. And in this particular case, back down to normal. All right, so we have cellular uptake of glucose is permitted, and then blood glucose concentration decreases. All right, so that is the response. What was the stimulus? What was the stimulus in this case? Increasing blood glucose, and how do they relate to each other? How does the stimulus and response relate to each other? Do they add together or subtract? They subtract. Right, 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 right. Ah, you found it. Okay, good, thank you. All right. Looks like you guys will be able to get the whole lecture. My voice won't wear out just yet. All right, let me see if I can hook this up. Volume's way up, I'll turn that down. I'll be with you in just a second. Oh, okay. Somebody left it on. Okay. Never mind. I don't want to take time to get that working. Okay, so here is one response loop when you're in the fed state. Insulin is necessary to decrease blood glucose concentration. Insulin is a hormone. It comes from the endocrine part of the pancreas, not the exocrine part. The pancreas has an exocrine part that produces digestive enzymes, and then they get into the digestive system via a duct. But insulin, right, just goes through a capillary into the cardiovascular system, so it's a hormone. All right, so that's one case. What's the other case? Fasting state. All right, when you're in a fasted state, what would you think would happen to blood glucose if you're not absorbing glucose from your digestive tract? Blood glucose is going to decrease, right? And then your body is going to lose homeostasis if that happens. So there's a mechanism to prevent that from happening or just to keep it within a normal range, suitable to support life. So fasted state, blood glucose goes down. But the pancreas, in particular the islets of Langerhans, have cells that can detect, they have receptors for glucose, and as it starts to decrease, it makes a decision to cut back on the secretion of insulin, because what's the effect of insulin on blood glucose? Decreasing. Ah, but that's the stimulus right here. So we don't want a large insulin signal. Pancreas decreases the amount of insulin it secretes or even stops secreting insulin and secretes another hormone. And this is glucagon. Okay, glucagon, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of glucagon, just as important as insulin, but hardly we mess with it. Glucagon can tell the liver to break down glycogen into its basic building block, which is glucose. And then the liver secretes that glucose into the blood, and that maintains blood glucose levels. All right, so glucagon increases, okay, blood glucose. And what does insulin do? Decreases blood glucose. So this is a particularly interesting slide, probably one of the most important concepts in the class. And that is, we see that these two hormones are working together, but in what fashion are they working together? How is insulin working with glucagon? In one word, in an antagonistic mechanism, right? Antagonistic mechanism. Could you think of one other situation in your body where there is an antagonism that provides for precise control and balance in some part of your body? Okay, muscles, for instance, right? You have the biceps that causes flexion, and you have the triceps that causes extension. If you had one or the other, that your arm wouldn't work, right? If you only had the biceps, every time it contracted, you'd give yourself a black eye, right? So you need something that works in opposition to each other, antagonistic motion, right, to provide for precise control and balance. And in the autonomic nervous system, how many divisions are you aware of in the autonomic nervous system? Yeah, so there's two. And guess what the relationship is between those? They're antagonistic to each other. Okay, so it's not a feudal relationship. It's a very powerful relationship that provides for precise control and balance. Here are two hormones that work antagonistically. We just talked about a nervous system that works antagonistically, the musculoskeletal system is arranged just that same way. Okay, so that's important. And be sure you understand antagonistic control, how important it is. Okay, yeah, so that's it for this chapter. Anybody have any questions on this? Okay, so just forget, don't forget, insulin and glucagon have opposite effects. But since they work together, you have precise control and balance over blood glucose levels, regardless if you're in the fed state or fasted state. They work together. Okay, that's it for chapter one. Chapter two. Ooh, this might be my favorite chapter. But we got to get through it. Pointer options, arrow options. Okay, nice. All right, so this is the chemistry chapter. And this chapter is really important. You're going to rely on this information through the whole class because we're going to talk about physical chemistry, and physical chemistry just determines how everything in our universe behaves, including inside our bodies. So you can understand a lot of physiology just by knowing something about chemistry, right? If you know a lot about physiology, it probably doesn't help you with chemistry, but the other way around sure works. First thing we're going to look at is the smallest piece of matter that we're going to deal with in this class, and these are atoms. So atoms are the smallest units of chemical elements, and sometimes we have a periodic table in here, sometimes not, but it's a table of all the elements that we can find on Earth. And if we look at each of those elements, they're composed of three basic particles. The three basic particles are protons, which have a positive charge, electrons, they have a negative charge, and neutrons are neutral. They have no electrical charge, right? So when I say charge, I mean electrical charge. Right, protons and electrons don't have the same size. They're a lot different in size, but in terms of electrical charge, they are exactly equal. Kind of mysterious how that is, right? All the way out to the millionth decimal point. They have exactly the same charge. And you find these particles in specific locations in an atom. So protons and neutrons are found in the very center of an atom. We call that a nucleus. So here's the nucleus of an atom. Right, so here we have a term nucleus, and now you know a whole bunch of meanings for nucleus. What does nucleus mean? What are some other meanings for nucleus? Nucleus. You guys know. Yeah, it's that place inside of a cell that has a membrane around it, at least our cells it does, and there's genetic material on the inside, like chromosomes. That's a nucleus. What's another example of a nucleus? Because you guys took anatomy not too long ago. How about if I say ganglion? Does that help ring a bell? A nucleus, okay, is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system. Right? So it's gray matter in the central nervous system. It looks different, and it kind of always acts as an integration center, right? A nucleus, like the basal nuclei, for instance. Okay, those are totally different concepts than nucleus in terms of atoms. So where do you find the nucleus again? On the outside or inside? Inside, right smack in the center. That's where neutrons and protons exist. Only neutrons and protons, no electrons, go into the nucleus. Electrons, on the other hand, just kind of fly around the nucleus, and in this class, we're just going to say pretty much in just circular orbitals, just like planets circle around our sun. So this is just the orbital solar system model of how an atom is put together. Okay, and so that's what you have to know. These names of these three particles and what electrical charge they have and where they belong. The one last thing here, which sort of is like physiology after we define what the structure is, you do want to know what is the relationship between a electron and a proton. Okay, do they repel each other or do they attract each other? Opposite charges attract each other. Same charges repel. So protons will repel each other. Electrons will repel each other. But if you put a proton and electron, they will attract each other. And the reason why that is because if you have an electron and you put a proton right on with it, what's the electrical charge? It is neutral, right? And that state of neutrality is a preferred state, okay? A state of being positive or negative is a high energy state. It's not a preferred state to be in, okay? So these are some atoms. We got a couple of numbers, okay? We have the atomic number. Let's start with this one. Atomic number is the number of protons that we see inside the nucleus. And this is really nicely color-coded. Who knows what color this is right here?
Purple.
Purple? Okay, purple. Right, so, oh, those are neutrons. I don't want to know that one. I want to know this one right here. What's that?
Blue.
Okay, so let's look for some blue protons. How many are in this atom right here? There's only one. Okay, that is the atomic number for this particular atom. And the atomic number determines, and it's the only thing that determines, what kind of element it is. So an example of an element would be like hydrogen. So this is a hydrogen atom. Another example would be calcium. Another sodium, another sulfur, and another would be phosphorus. These are all elements, and I'm going to show you a periodic table in just a second. Okay. So that tells us how many protons are inside the nucleus, and if you change the number of protons in the nucleus, what are you changing? Not that we can. You're changing what kind of element it is, whether it's silver or gold or hydrogen or oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, just by changing the number of protons. You'll see how that's arranged in the periodic table really quickly. Atomic mass is not just protons inside the nucleus, but it's also you have to add together the neutrons that are in there, right? So the atomic mass is the whole weight of the nucleus, not just the protons that are in there. Now here I have an example of hydrogen. And what is the atomic number on hydrogen? It's one. What's the atomic mass of hydrogen? It's one as well, right? Because there are no neutrons. If we jam some neutrons in there, let's just say let's jam two neutrons in there, what would the atomic mass be then? It would be three, okay? All right, so if we change the number of neutrons inside the nucleus, we do not change what kind of element it is, all right? It's still going to be calcium, still going to be phosphorus, but it will have different properties, and sometimes they become a little radioactive or a lot radioactive. Okay, so sometimes they're used in medicine, but we're really not going to focus on atomic mass in here because we're not getting into high-energy physics, right? So the most important concept on this slide is number of protons changes what element it is. And one is hydrogen, and here we're going to count six protons. If an atom has six protons, could it be hydrogen? No. And if we look at the periodic table, we're going to see that it is carbon. And it just so happens this form of carbon has six neutrons in the nucleus. Carbon is neutral all by itself. So how many electrons should this carbon atom have? It should have six. Okay. And these six electrons are going to put in these orbitals around the nucleus, and sometimes we call these shells. The shell that's closest to the nucleus can only accept two electrons. That's the maximum that will fit in that particular shell. Even though there's six on carbon, only two can fit in there. All right, so I see two electrons in that first orbital, and what does that mean? How many are left over? There are four left over, and those have to go into the next orbital. The next orbital can contain eight electrons. All right, so we can fill this up with eight, but then carbon is no longer neutral. So that's really not a preferred state. Okay, so we got six protons, six electrons. What's the overall charge of this carbon atom? It's neutral, right? Okay. Let me see what the next slide. Okay, I talked about this, electron shells or orbitals. Shells depend on atomic number, which is what, the number of protons inside the atom. The first shell can only have two, the second can have eight, the third can have eight, and then it gets a little bit more complicated after that. This last statement right here is not important for our class. You don't have to know this. Okay. But you do have to know this. The electrons in the outermost shell are what we call valence electrons. Valence electrons, and valence electrons determine the chemical properties of that element. It determines how that atom is going to interact with other atoms, and that's what we call chemistry. And chemistry takes place by these atoms forming bonds with each other to form a more stable state, a lower energy state. So these valence electrons participate in chemical reactions by breaking and forming bonds. So we're going to be really interested in these valence electrons, because maybe you have heard of something called an electrolyte. Anybody ever hear of an electrolyte? Probably if you work anywhere in a hospital, you've heard of things like magnesium and sodium, potassium. These are elements that have an electrical charge on them, and so they are called electrolytes. And they're very important in our bodies because, believe it or not, we are very electrical beings. Every cell in our body acts like a battery because of these electrical charges. So we're going to become familiar with that. Okay, so where do you find valence electrons? In the last shell. And we have to know something about them, because what do they allow to happen between atoms? Yeah, they allow chemistry to form bonds or break bonds. So we want to be familiar with them. Okay, isotopes. The same atom. So if they're the same atom, okay, but they're isotopes of each other, what about the number of protons inside the nucleus? It's going to be the same. I switched the slide. Yeah, same number of protons. But it's going to be a different number of neutrons. So the atomic mass is going to change. So isotopes are the same element because the protons don't change, but the number of neutrons changes, and that helps determine the stability of that nucleus. Changes its nuclear properties. Okay, what did we say about positive charges? Attract or repel each other? Only positive charges. They repel each other. Opposite charges attract. And so you might be a little confused, because what do you have inside the nucleus? Only? Do you have any electrons in the nucleus? No. Only protons. But we said protons repel each other. How can you get all of those positive charges inside the nucleus without it wanting to break apart? Okay. And that's where neutrons come in. The more protons that are in the nucleus, the more it wants to break apart. Then there have to be more neutrons in there to keep things together. So that's kind of its job, in a nutshell. You won't be tested on that, but that's why they're there. Okay. And depending on the number of neutrons, then some nuclei do like to fly apart, and then they become radioactive. They can be used for imaging studies and things like that, but then they can also damage tissue. Here is an important list. Don't know if this is in your textbook or not. I don't know if I got it from your textbook, McGraw-Hill. Could be in your textbook. Of all the elements that we see on a periodic table, these are the ones that I want you to know their name, like oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, magnesium, sodium, sulfur, and even these down over here, manganese, iodine. I want you to know the name of these elements, but in real life, when we're writing something down, we don't use the long word form. We come up with an abbreviated form for this word, and we call it the chemical symbol. And I do want you to know these chemical symbols and how they relate to the names of these elements. All right, so since these are elements, what can you tell me about the number of protons inside the nucleus of these elements right here? Are any of them the same? No, they're all going to be different. And that's really the only thing that makes one element different from another. Okay, so let's take a look at this. Usually it's pretty easy to tell. Like O for oxygen, C for carbon, H for hydrogen, N for nitrogen. All right, that's really obvious. But you could get tricked on a couple of these examples. All right, so what about sodium? You would want to say S for sodium, but that doesn't work, right? Because everybody agrees that the symbol for sodium is Na, capital N, little a. And that's because its Greek name, sodium's Greek name, is natrium. Natrium. So that's where that came from. All right. But you just have to memorize that. What are some other funny ones? What about iron? You would think, well, maybe that should be I, capital I. Is iron I? It is not. It is Fe. But there is an I, and what is I? Iodine. Okay. So you don't have to memorize the whole periodic table, but you do have to know these. And it's not important that you know this third column over here, just the first two columns. And of course, we're going to be using those through the whole semester. Let me take a look at the next slide. Okay, now I want to pull up the periodic table, but I can't unless I end the show right here. And, yeah. Probably only in the form of lecture notes. Okay, so you do have a copy of it because you have the slides from lecture, and that's in there. All right, let me see if I can get the periodic table somehow shown. Let's do this, let's do that. Where did it go? Is it here? No. Switch this. Yeah, and my monitor too. So there's a lot of buttons I can't get to. I can't even get a cursor on them. So that is problematic for me. Because this periodic table goes, I see it here. We got a shot. Okay. What is that? Two? Let's try this. Two and two. Both sides of the room can look at it. Nice. Okay, so here's the periodic table. And I got this from the chemistry department. This is the periodic table that is given to all of their students. And it's mislabeled. Do I have any kind of cursor? Come on, cursor. Oh, it's on the other monitor. Can I get it back? Oh, I saw it for a second. Here we go. Okay, it's mislabeled. It's labeled atomic masses. And atomic masses are in this table, but it's really called the periodic table. What I'm going to give you on an exam is something that's called the periodic table. You might have one in the back of your book. Maybe you can remember, we first talked about hydrogen. How many protons did you find in the nucleus of hydrogen? It's in your notes if you want to just flip back. Yeah, that's the simplest one. That's really nice and easy. How many electrons does hydrogen have? It's got one, right? Because proton and neutron will neutralize each other. This periodic table is pretty fancy. Guess what the number one element is on the periodic table? But of course you have to know what the chemical symbol is. What does H stand for? Hydrogen. And this number on the top, that's the atomic number. It tells you that there is one proton inside the nucleus. And there is an element, okay, that has two protons inside the nucleus. And so you would look around the table. Here's one that's got 3, here's one 4, here's one with 20, 39. Oh, it looks like we're going in the wrong direction, 72. We want to find one with two protons in the nucleus. You see one like that anywhere? All the way over, oh yeah, here on the other side. And HE stands for helium. You don't have to know this because biologically it's not important. It never interacts unless you're at a party, right? And you can change your voice. Okay, and so this number right here means that there are two protons inside the nucleus, different than hydrogen, so they are different elements. All right. Now, you might be wondering, how come there are no other elements in this row right here? Because this corresponds to how electrons are laid out in orbitals. The first orbital, how many electrons did we say were in that first orbital? Only two. So you're going to have this table on a test, and you could just rely on it. You don't have to memorize how many electrons are in which orbital because here it tells you. Here's your answer key. One electron, two electrons in that first orbital. What about the second orbital? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Just like what we said. All right, so there's a lot of nice symmetry and beauty in this periodic table. We won't go into a whole lot of detail, but some of that. So don't forget, you got to know the chemical symbol for some of these important atoms. Like what? Sulfur, phosphorus, iron, iodine, that's in that table. Make sure you can find them on this periodic table because I might ask you, for instance, what might I ask you? I might ask you, how many protons are in the nucleus of phosphorus? So how are you going to start with that? You probably want to know what the chemical symbol for phosphorus is, which is P. So you can look around, where do you see a P? Where's a P? More on the right, PPP. Here's P. So how many protons are in the nucleus of phosphorus? 15. Yeah, there's just 15. And in order for that to be neutral, it needs 15 electrons. And how many orbitals does phosphorus need to be all filled up with electrons? 1, 2, 3. And that third orbital is not completely filled up. It's still got 3 spaces left. Okay, that outer orbital. So this is the outer orbital, and the electrons in that outer orbital are called what kind of electrons? Valence electrons, and they then provide for the chemical properties of this particular element. Okay. What else do I want to say about periodic table? I could go the other way around. I could pick a number of protons in the nucleus, which we call atomic number of 16, and then I could ask you what element it is. But I wouldn't use the chemical symbol because it's on the periodic table. I could say sodium, sulfur, all right, and you just have to know the proper chemical symbol, right? Not for this whole periodic table, but just the ones that are on the previous slide. All right, who's got a question about that? You could print this out, and maybe with a yellow highlighter or pink highlighter, just highlight the elements that you have to know, just to get a feel for where they are on the periodic table. Look at the atomic number, just get a feel for the atomic number. You don't have to memorize any of that because you'll have the table during the exam. I'll either project it or give you a hard copy. Probably give you a hard copy of it. Okay? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When you were indicating how many electrons are in each, is that group? Right?
I would say orbital or shell. Orbital or shell.
So the
valence,
right?
The valence would be 2 for the first shell.
Okay.
And for the second shell would be 8. Third shell would be 8. Okay. And you can just count this over. So here is the first, this row is the first shell. Second shell is the second row. The third shell is the third row. And then it gets a little bit more complicated. There are other kinds of orbitals then once you get down into this level right here. Ah, what's K? Ooh, who knows what K stands for? Potassium. That's another strange one, right? And it's not P because, well, phosphorus is P, but it's K because it's derived from the Greek word kalium. Kalium, which is K. Okay. I think that answers your question pretty good. Yeah. All right. So some of this stuff you maybe have never thought about before, a little bit strange compared to your biology background, but this is all really good, super important information for you to know. All right. Any other question about this periodic table? That's just the level that I want you to become familiar with. Okay. So let me put that away. Let's see if I can find those PowerPoint slides once again. Something like this. Something like that. Okay, there's a button for it. I see the button. Here's the cursor. Chapter 2. Slideshow mode. All right, so these are the elements and chemical symbols you have to be familiar with. True. We're just there. Yeah, I guess that's as close as I can get it. I can just get it on one side. Did I have it on both monitors? Yeah. How did I do that? I wonder. How did I do that? All right, let's go to here. There's a way. Interesting. I figured out a way how to do it, but I have forgotten. Okay, so I think just for the sake of time, well, I'm going to just show it on one monitor. Okay. All right. So now we're into, since we know the structure of an atom, we're going to start talking about chemical bonds. And what about a chemical, what about an atom? What relates to chemical bonds? Formation of chemical bonds when you think of the orbital theory of an atom. Kind of an advanced question, but we talked about it in a roundabout way, and that is the valence electrons, the valence electrons. And have a picture in your mind of where those valence electrons are. Okay, so molecules are formed. So an atom is just a single element all by itself. If we put a couple elements together, now we get a molecule. Molecules stay together because they can form bonds, they form an association with each other, which is more stable compared to if they were just existing by themselves. And that's because they do something with these valence electrons. Okay. The number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. So even though an element is stable, like we looked at carbon, right, even though it doesn't have an electrical charge, if it only has 6 electrons in the outermost shell, it is unhappy. It needs to be filled up. And how many did we say in the second shell? I took the periodic table away, sorry. But you could count it over and you'd see 8. So carbon needs, if it has six, yeah. Oh, four? Four. Let me go back. Yeah, two in the first, four in the second one. There's six altogether. Ah, here's carbon. Yeah. Okay. There are four in the outermost shell, not six, because here's the first two in the first shell. So how many electrons does carbon need to fill up this outer shell? One, two, three, four. It needs four electrons from somebody, okay, to fill this up. And let's continue back to where we were, right here. So it becomes stable if that outermost shell is completely filled with electrons or if it has no electrons. An element is happy with either, which then means that the next inner shell is all filled up with electrons, right? It's got to be all filled up. All right, so the first kind of bond we're going to be talking about in this class, we're going to say it is the strongest bond, a covalent bond. And that is true when we talk about humans and animals because we're in a water solution, right? The most abundant molecule in us is water, and we're just a bag of water with a bunch of stuff dissolved in it, okay? And in a water solution, covalent bonds are the strongest. Maybe not in every circumstance in chemistry, but in an aqueous solution, this is true. So let's look at this atom right here. I see how many protons in the nucleus right here? I just see one. So there should be one electron in the outermost shell. I got to get my arrow back. Hold on. Okay. And so it has one electron. This particular atom of hydrogen, what is it looking for if there's one electron in that outermost shell? It's looking for one more from someplace to fill it up, right? Okay. Here is another hydrogen atom, and it has one electron. And what is it looking for to become stable, to fill that outermost shell? It's looking for an electron as well. Well, these two can bump into each other, and this one says, well, you know what? I'd be willing to share mine with you if you share your electron with me, and then that, I will feel like there's two electrons in my outermost shell. And this atom over here says, sure, because then I'll feel like I have two electrons in my outermost shell. That's what we call a covalent bond. Right? So a covalent bond is when, just a key term, is when two atoms share electrons, right? Covalent and sharing is the key concept I want you to see right there. All right, so here we have a hydrogen molecule, which is H2. And these two electrons sometimes are over here, sometimes they're over here, and they just are in these different locations an equal amount of time. They're just shared equally. Sometimes they're here, same amount of time they're over here. They just kind of wing around on these different orbitals. This is what we call a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons they can go anywhere. They can be over here, the exact same amount of time they'll be over here. They don't predominantly just sit in one location on this molecule. Right? That's a nonpolar covalent bond. Okay, as opposed to nonpolar, there's something called a polar covalent bond. And this is important because we could take everything in your body and break it down into two kinds of pieces. And the two kinds of pieces are polar pieces and nonpolar pieces. You've never thought of yourself that way. But we're going to be really involved with understanding your body in terms of polarity. Is it polar or nonpolar? All right, so here is a bond that is what? Nonpolar. And it's nonpolar because these electrons can be found an equal amount of time at any location. All right, here is another kind of bond. It's a covalent bond because oxygen and hydrogen are going to be, okay, they're going to be doing something with electrons. If it's a covalent bond, what do they do with electrons? They share. Okay, but this is a polar covalent bond. I have a marker. I'm going to write this on the board. Let's build this molecule. Oh, you don't. Anybody have a periodic table with them?
Yeah.
You do. Good, because I don't want to bop out of this program. Okay, so we got oxygen. Let's put oxygen here. How many protons are inside the nucleus? How would you find that? By looking at a periodic table. Oxygen has six. All right, so oxygen has six protons in the nucleus. So in that first shell, how many electrons? More than enough, right? Two. right? Which means how many are left? Okay, there's four. They can't go in the first shell, they got to go in the second shell. All right, so we got... Yeah, I think we got eight going. I think we got eight going. Carbon has six. Okay. Okay, we got eight. That was going to cause a problem for me. Okay, so here are two electrons, here and here. So now how many are left? Six. Okay, so we got one, two, three, four. Oh, we got two more to put someplace. We'll just say five, six, like so. How many electrons does this oxygen need to become stable? Just two. And you already know an element that has an electron to share, and we just need two of them. What is the element that will share one electron?
Hydrogen.
Right? So on this oxygen, hydrogen has one proton inside the nucleus. It's got one orbital with an electron in it over here. Right, and here is another hydrogen atom with one proton in it. Here is an orbital right here, and it's going to share an electron like that. Now, if you look at oxygen, how many electrons are in the outer shell? There are eight, right? So it's happy. What about the outer shell of this hydrogen? Two, these two right here, because it's only sharing these electrons. What about this hydrogen here? It's got one and two. Maybe I'll put that down a little bit closer. All right, so these are covalent bonds. It's when two electrons are shared between two atoms. That's a covalent bond. Remember, sharing is the key term. All right. Now, here's something that is kind of nasty about this oxygen. Because of the properties of oxygen, it is very greedy. It likes to grab all of these electrons. It really doesn't like to share with these protons over here. So at any particular time, you're going to find more electrons here than here. All right. Before I said that, I probably should have said, if we look at water from the back of the room, what's the overall charge? We got 8, 9, 10 protons and 10 electrons. Right? So it's going to be neutral. No net electrical charge if you're looking at it from far away. But because this oxygen doesn't really like to share these electrons, they're mostly found in this part of the molecule. This part of the molecule has a little bit of a negative charge. These ends of the molecule then have to have a little bit of a positive charge. Here and here. Not a whole charge like an electron or a proton, but a little bit of an electrical charge. Okay, these two positive charges match that negative right there. So, if you come upon a water molecule from this direction, what does it look like? Positive. If you come upon a water molecule in this direction, it looks negative, and that's what we mean by polarity. Different ends of the molecule have some different nature, just like the Earth has two poles, but it's not electrical charge, it's a magnetic field. Polar just means that it has two opposite natures on different parts of the molecule. Overall, water is neutral. All right, so we just built this molecule here. You could do that with any number of molecules now that you know orbital theory, okay, and that these are covalent bonds, but they're not nonpolar. It's a polar covalent bond. And that polar nature inside you is really important, but you do have another nature. You have a nonpolar nature too, which we're going to talk about. Okay, so not only oxygen can produce polar covalent bonds, but let me see if I can remember the whole list. And I think this will be important for you to remember the whole list. So we got what? Oxygen, because that's right here. Phosphorus does the same thing. It likes to grab hold of electrons and pull them into the nucleus. We have nitrogen, okay, and then S. What's S? Sulfur. What do we got on our list right here? Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus. It omitted S. Don't forget about S. That's sulfur, right? So these things produce polar covalent bonds. So in water, things will dissolve in water if they have a little bit of an electrical charge, right? If they're a little bit negative, they will dissolve in water because here is a positive charge. that will neutralize it. If something has a positive charge, right, it will dissolve in water because water has a little bit of a negative charge, and they will neutralize each other. So let's maybe look at the next slide. Okay. We're going to now talk about, yeah. Oh, okay. What kind of compound will, it's really important. Yeah, that's a good question. What kind of compound will dissolve in water? Right, you got a glass of water. What kind of covalent bonds are these? These are what? Polar? Right, polar. Right. So any kind of compound that is a polar compound will dissolve in water. So those like substances will dissolve because the negative part of a molecule that we add in here is going to form up with this positive charge. If we put another molecule in that has a positive charge, then it's going to easily associate with this other end of the water molecule because it's negative. So anything that has charges, electrical charges, or polarity will dissolve in water. So we say water is a polar solvent. Okay, and that's the major part of you. You're mostly polar. And polar, the first molecule I think of when I say polar is water. So you're mostly water world. But you are also part lipid world, and we're going to talk about that. But mostly water world, yeah. Nope. They will repel each other. Just in passing, a good example of a nonpolar substance would be oil, butter, something like that. And you know that oil and butter just won't have anything to do with water because they have two different natures. One is polar, the other is nonpolar. But that's going to be huge in terms of how your cells are put together. Okay? All right, so let's move on to another kind of bond. And after we look at this bond, we can kind of put these things together. Ionic bonds, in most circumstances, are very, very strong, except if you put these compounds in water. Okay, they're not as strong as a covalent bond. So in some chemistry classes you'll take, when you're not dealing with water, ionic bonds will be very strong. But in this class, you're going to understand that ionic bonds are not as strong as covalent. So in the hierarchy of strength, you got covalent first, in terms of strength, most stable. Ionic, not so stable. Ionic bonds can form and break apart very easily when it's in a water environment. So, let's look at some elements that can form ionic bonds. Here is an atom. It's got 11 protons inside the nucleus. So, too bad I don't have a periodic table, because how would I find what it is? I would just look down the list, find that thing that has 11 protons, and you're going to see that P stands for protons, not phosphorus. You're going to see that the atomic number right here, which is 11, corresponds to Na, which is sodium, right? Okay, so if it has 11 protons in the nucleus, what does a native sodium atom have? If it's got 11 protons, 11 electrons, exactly the same to be neutral. So let's fill up the shells. The first one has 2. And you can see that on the periodic table. The next one has 8, right? So that's 10 altogether, which means what is left over? 1. So on the outer shell, you only have 1 electron. Now, what does this sodium atom think about that? Very unhappy, because it wants it filled up all the way. It doesn't want to have just 1. Okay, so it's really wanting to get rid of this 1 electron, that 1 valence electron, so that its outer shell has all 8. It's completely filled up. So sodium likes to get rid of an electron. All right, let's go to the next part. Here we have an atom, right? And how many protons are in the nucleus of this atom? 17. We got 11 over here. So could these be the same elements? They cannot, because they have different number of protons. This is sodium, and this happens, if you look on your periodic table, that's what we call chlorine. That's a chlorine atom. And that chlorine atom has to have 17 electrons in all these orbitals, so let's build those up. How many in the first? 2. How many in the second? 8. So what is that? That is 10. So how many are left over? 7. Put those 7 in the last orbital, and is that the most stable configuration? No. It wants an electron from someplace, and then it becomes stable. And it bumps into a sodium. And what does sodium want to do? It wants to get rid of one, and chlorine wants to get one. That's a perfect of arrangement right there. All right, so this electron hops over to here, and now you have these two particles, one with a positive charge, right, because it's lost an electron. This one over here has a negative charge because it's gained one electron. And what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So these two elements attract each other and form sodium chloride, right, which is just table salt in this ionic form. Okay. So these are what we call ions. When the number of electrons does not match the number of protons inside the nucleus, there's some leftover charge. It could be a leftover positive charge, leftover negative charge. Those are ions. Sometimes we call them electrolytes because they have those electrical properties associated with them. If it is a particle with a positive charge, we're going to call that a cation. And that's going to be a lot different than a particle that has one extra electron. We're going to call that an anion. All right, so cations and anions are definitely different. Their chemistry is a lot different. I had an organic chemistry teacher write this on the board. And so you'll remember the definition for cation and anion, but it will haunt you for the rest of your life. I don't know. You want to see it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so this is it right here. All right, okay, little nose right here, a couple eyeballs. Oh, ooh, okay, there. A cation, okay, so a cation has positive charges, anion, negative charge. Okay, something else that, before we get to the next slide, that doesn't describe an electrolyte completely, because we might have an electrolyte like calcium, capital C, little a, and it doesn't have just one positive charge, it has two positive charges. If it has two positive charges, it's different than an electrolyte that has one, so we got to name it differently. So is this an anion or a cation? It's a cation, okay? That's not the complete description. The complete description would be a bivalent or divalent. Bi or di means two, okay? This is wrong. It's really hard to find calcium in this configuration. But let's just say it has three positive charges. Would that be a bivalent? No, it would be a trivalent, right? So that terminology is really important to know. And something that looks like that, that would be a monovalent. All right, if you got X right here with one negative, that would be what? Monovalent anion. And if you got this element right here, that would be a trivalent anion, right? So we need to use that terminology when we talk about electrolytes. Okay, you probably know some electrolytes. Well, we see sodium here, chlorine, or there's calcium. What are some other electrolytes that maybe you've heard of already? Magnesium, potassium, right? They exist as ions, either monovalent or bivalent anions or cations. Oh, what about this chlorine right here? Could you describe to me what kind of ion that is? It's a monovalent anion. Yeah, exactly right. Okay. All right. Well, since these have electrical charge on them, the sodium has an electrical charge and chlorine has an electrical charge, you think it will like to associate itself with this polar molecule right here, water. Let's take chloride. Right, so chloride has a negative charge, it's a monovalent anion. Put it next to a water molecule, will they repel each other or ignore each other, or will they attract each other? They'll attract, because chlorine is negative, but here's a nice positive end of a water molecule. Chlorine will just jam right in there, be really happy. Another chloride, jam right in over here. Right, and if you put chloride in there, you might also have some sodium if it was salt, right? So you're gonna have some positive charges. Where would that sodium go? It would go right here. Right, so if you take that crystal of sodium chloride, put it in water, that sodium and chloride is going to break apart and associate with water, and we just call that what? Dissolving right in water. And you can just pour a ton of salt in water because they're both polar compounds. They both have that same nature in terms of polarity. How does that happen? All right, so here you have a sodium atom and it's a monovalent cation, look at all the oxygen parts of a water molecule wanting to, okay, just associate itself with the sodium. The negative part of water will be pointing to the outside. And chloride, on the other hand, is negative, so the positive part of water is going to want to associate with the chlorine, and the negative parts are going to be pointing out. So we call these hydration spheres. So polar compounds will dissolve in water very easily because hydration spheres form around these different particles. Okay, and it's all based on the electrical properties of the molecules. Okay, so sodium chloride dissolves very easily. So this brings us to these two natures that we see inside our bodies. One is polar, one is nonpolar. And we see what kind of compound is water? Negative here, positive down over there. It's polar, right? Hydro means water. Hydrophilic means loving water, right? So we know that water is a polar compound. If some other molecule is polar, it loves water because it's polar as well. So any kind of hydrophilic molecule will dissolve in water very easily, as opposed to hydrophobic molecules, ones that have no polarity whatsoever, no overall electrical charge, completely neutral in electrical charge. They just don't want to have anything to do with water because it has a different nature. It has a polar nature to it. Good examples of hydrophobic or nonpolar compounds will be steroids, will be triglycerides, fat, for instance. Those would be really good examples. Gasoline, oil in your car. I think we're set. How do we make the ringer go away? Do you know how to do that? I just turned that little thing off there. Okay. There's another button I think you can tell to go away. All right, so these are your two natures. And different parts of the cell have these two different natures. Glucose and amino acids are hydrophilic, okay, because they form these hydration spheres. And let me show you why glucose and amino acids, let's just talk about glucose. All right, so here's a glucose. It's got carbon, right? But on this carbon, there is an oxygen and a hydrogen. There's an OH group. And so here's a hydrogen bound to an oxygen. What can you tell me about this oxygen right here? Will it share electrons equally with this hydrogen, or will it want to grab more of the electronegativity of this hydrogen? It wants to grab more away. So the sugar molecule has this part to it, which allows it to dissolve in water, right? And you're familiar with that. Sugar dissolves in water very easily because actually it's got a lot of these OH groups, and they're all very polar because of that oxygen right there. Or we can substitute what? Phosphorus, nitrogen, or sulfur, and it would like to dissolve in water as well because those produce polar covalent bonds. Okay, water molecules, because they are polar, like to join together, right? They are sticky. Water molecules just love to stick together, right? When opposite charges from different molecules associate, this is another kind of bond, and it's much weaker than an ionic bond. So what was the strongest one we looked at so far? Covalent. The next strongest is ionic, and a weak one is hydrogen. Now some, of course, water is sticky, and on the surface it produces something called surface tension, and it's so sticky some animals can even just walk right on the surface of water because the water molecules don't want to break apart from each other. What kind of animal have you seen walking right on the surface of water? Like a spider, right? Or a water bug, for instance, that would work too. So very light animals, right, don't even go kaplunk because they can't exert enough force to push the water molecules apart. So water is sticky, and we're going to look at that, okay, a little bit later on. So hydrogen bonds are the weakest. There's one more bond that's even weaker. I need to write this on the board because it's not done in the book very well. It's called a van der Waals force. And maybe some textbooks and instructors wouldn't even call it a bond because it is so weak. But I think I want you to rank these bonds in terms of strength. What's the strongest one? Covalent. Next strongest? Ionic. Next strongest? But weak. And then what's the weakest, weakest? Van der Waals forces. Okay. And I think, what do we, oh, that's not the right time, is it? I just remember that. We go to what, 12:45? Okay, so, good. All right, so van der Waals forces are the weakest. These are associations between nonpolar molecules. Right? And so it's a very, very weak association, but any kind of nonpolar molecule will like to associate with other nonpolar molecules. If you have one kind of oil, you can let it dissolve in another kind of oil, right? Because they're both nonpolar compounds. Okay, here is a pretty important part of the class because we're going to talk about pH along with acids and bases. And pH is just a measure of the acidity or the alkalinity, which means what? The basic nature, either the acidic or basic nature of a water solution. We can determine how acidic or basic a solution is, right, if we know its pH. All right, so let's look at pH just a little bit. Here are some examples of acids. Hydrochloric acid is HCl. Okay, and when you put HCl in water, hydrogens will dissociate for chlorine, and you'll have two electrolytes right here. One's a cation, one's an anion, completely dissociate. And you'll have a lot of these hydrogen ions, which is just a proton floating around in solution. Does a proton like to dissolve in solution? Where is it going to associate? Nicely with this negative part of a water molecule. Put a lot of protons. Another name for a proton is a hydrogen ion. Hydrogen is exactly the same thing, right? Now you could look at that periodic table and just draw that right up. So an acid is a compound that will donate these protons to a water solution. Hydrochloric acid loves to do that, completely dissociate. We call that a strong acid. All right, here is another acid, phosphoric acid. It has three protons and a phosphorus and this oxygen right here. Some of these protons like to jump off of this molecule, and then that hydrogen ion is added to a solution and it becomes more acidic because the hydrogen ion concentration is increasing. Same thing for nitric acid, that hydrogen can come off. Sulfuric acid, two of these hydrogen ions can come off. Carbonic acid, these protons can come off and dissolve into water. So that's what the definition of an acid is. It releases hydrogen ions, what's another name for a hydrogen ion? A proton, because there's that H plus, into a water solution. A base, on the other hand, does not do that. It will donate hydroxide ions into solution. Here's a hydroxide. OH is hydroxide. Here are some examples of bases: sodium hydroxide, potassium, calcium, ammonium hydroxide. Not biologically important, but you can find some of these things around in your house. And here is that hydroxide anion. So what do we get if we take this proton right here, or hydrogen ion, with this hydroxide anion? What do you get? You got H plus, and we get an OH. What will that make? Under the right circumstances, that will make H2O, which is what? Just what we have right here. Okay, so water can dissociate all by itself, okay, to produce hydrogen ions and OHs. But if you have an equal number of these and these, what's the overall charge in a water solution? If you have as many of these as these, is it positive or negative? No, it's absolutely neutral, right? And in terms of pH, we're going to say it's neutral as well. Okay. All right, so here are some examples of common acids and bases. All right, pH. pH is just a symbol for the hydrogen ion concentration. How much of what? How much of this is in a water solution? And it's a scale that goes from 0 to 14, so it's not a whole lot of big numbers. And we can have some decimal points on there, but usually not too many of them. And here is a nice algebraic equation that interconverts pH into hydrogen ion concentration, or hydrogen ion concentration into pH. And it is the inverse log to the base 10 of the hydrogen ion concentration. Or you could put hydrogen ion concentration up here in the numerator and put a minus sign in front of this log. Okay, that's just a little algebraic manipulation. So here is something that you have to know how to do on your calculator. This log button is log to the base 10. So on your calculator, you might see a little 10 right here. And there's another log. There's something called ln. That's not what we want to use. That's not the button you want to push, right? Log to the base 10. We said pure water is what? Exactly equal numbers of these things. Absolutely neutral. And if it's absolutely neutral, it's going to be the number right in the middle of 0 to 14, which is happens to be 7. Right? So pH of 7 is absolutely neutral. Now here is something that's just a little bit funny. Acids have a pH number less than 7. Okay, less than 7. Bases have a pH number that's greater than 7. So let me just draw that out really quick. A couple things. Oh, good. We can get through this. All right, so we said we have a pH scale right here. We just got done saying that right smack in the middle is 7, right? And that is what? Sorry about you guys being in the back. That's neutral. pH 7 is neutral, neither acidic nor basic. And let's just use a regular number line. So let's just say the numbers over here get smaller. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And what does the pH scale begin with? 0. So here's a pH of 0. This statement that I just read to you says as the pH number decreases, what happens to the solution? Does it become more acid or more basic? Acid. All right, so this is acid here. And if we go the other way, 8, 9, and what's the last number? 14. This is what? Basic. Okay, according to the pH. All right. Here I've got a couple beakers. And we got to use water because pH only makes sense if you're talking about water. And this, I'm going to start over here just to confuse you a little bit. Here I have a hydrogen ion. Here's a hydroxide. Here's another hydroxide. Here's another hydrogen ion. Another hydrogen ion, another hydroxide. Can you tell me if this is an acidic or basic solution? How would you know? You just count the number of protons and hydroxides, right? So I see 1, 2, 3 hydrogen ions. How many hydroxides? 1, 2, 3. They exactly balance each other out. So this is what? Neutral. And it just so happens we know what is the pH of a neutral solution? It's 7. Okay? All right. Now let's go to this beaker over here. And it just so happens that it's got this in it. You got to have some OHs in there. But now, what is this one right here? Positive. Is this acidic or basic? It's acidic because it has a lot more protons than it does hydroxides. Now, what's the pH of this? The more hydroxide ions you have, what happens to the pH number? This is really confusing until you get the hang of it. It goes down. So you put more hydrogen ions in it, you have to go in this direction on the pH scale. It's called an inverse relationship. Okay? As something increases, the other thing related to it decreases. And that's what you see right here. Right? The hydrogen ion is in the denominator of this equation, which produces an inverse relationship. We're going to use that a lot to describe things in physiology. Right? Directly related or inversely related. So let's do that again. As the hydrogen ion increases, what about acidity? Acidity increases, hydrogen ion increases, acidity increases. What about the pH number? Decreases. It goes the other way. Okay? All right, so that's strange. Should we do this last example? Let's do hydroxide, 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 and hydrogen ion. Acidic, neutral, or basic? Basic. More hydroxide ions. Now, what about the pH number? Here, the acidity is what? Going down, but what about the pH number? It's going up, all right? Again, you got to just rely on that inverse relationship. Just think inverse relationship. Number gets bigger. The acidity goes down. All right, and here is a nice table that kind of shows why that is. Here is pH. So this is a nice, simple scale, right? It only goes from 0 to 14. If we want to measure the hydrogen ion concentration, if we start at 1, right, very easy to find. something on the opposite end, 10 to the 14th, power. All right, so here we have the number 1. And then over here, we're going to put, 0.1. And then over here, we're going to put 0.01. How many times did we have to do this to represent the whole pH scale? Yeah, 14 times until we had a number with, 14 zeros. Well, that's very uncomfortable to do that. You can't do that on a piece of paper. But we can convert these big, huge numbers into something that is very manageable with that equation, the pH equation, right? So it just so happens, what's neutral again? 7. The hydrogen ion concentration is 10 to the minus 7, so you see a 7 here. That's a pH of 7. What about the hydroxide concentration? Minus 7, exactly equal. And we said when it's exactly equal, then it is a neutral solution, and that happens exactly at pH 7. Okay, what about pH 7.3? Is that acidic or basic or neutral? 7.3. Little bit basic, okay? Not by much. You might say, well, gee whiz, that's really neutral. But that's really important. That small amount of change from 7 to 7.3 is really important for our physiology. Our physiology is very sensitive to small changes in pH, even like 0.3 decimal points of a change in pH. Nice. All right, I'm not going to talk about this, but I want to introduce this to you. Okay, the concept of a buffer. A buffer is a molecule that when you put into a water solution like this, okay, it will resist a change in the concentration of hydrogen ion or hydroxide anion. It will maintain the pH to be the same. So for instance, if we have an acidic solution and we have a buffer in there, and we add hydrogen ions, which would make most solutions what? If we add hydrogen ions, it will make most solutions more acidic or less? More acidic, smaller pH number. But if there's a buffer in there, the pH is not going to change because the buffer is going to gobble up these hydrogen ions. Right? The pH won't change. A buffer doesn't maintain neutrality. It doesn't force something to 7. It will just maintain the pH. And it's not only for just hydrogen ions. If we drop hydroxide ions in there, the pH won't change either. So either way it goes. It will gobble up hydrogen ions or it will gobble up hydroxide ions and maintain a constant pH. What would you like to do with your body? Have a pH that is moving around drastically or more stable? More stable, right? So we got to have buffers in our body to do that. And we're going to look at a number of different buffers through the whole semester. Okay, so make sure you sign the science sheet, and your SI leader has an announcement.